Welcome back to the show. This is Brett Williams. This is Classical Guitar Insider, brought to you from the El Nora Guitar Festival at the University of Illinois at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. They were kind enough to bring me out there, where I compiled 12 or 13 interviews with musicians across all genres who were guests at the festival. It was an incredible experience. They flew me out, put me up. At one point, there was a ham sandwich that appeared out of nowhere in my office. It was a beautiful. The office was purple with some attractive, some tasteful lighting, and plenty of space for everybody. I don't know what to say except for thank you to Carrie Lombardi, who is the publicist extraordinaire, who arranged things the way they're meant to be arranged. You know, usually when I contact somebody, it's like, hey, does anybody got Billy's number? But, you know, with her, she did it the way the pros do it. She reached out to the publicist, who, of course, has the schedules for the artists that I try to connect with. And it was done in a way where everybody felt professional. Everybody felt safe. I still kept the thread of Classical Guitar Insider there. But from now on, I think we're gonna go with this, because what I started doing was I started doing shorter, tighter interviews, and I would like that to translate into shorter, tighter episodes. So we're going to start seeing shows that are lasting under an hour, for example. What was great about this festival was me and one of the presenters from the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, Mike Ross, is going to come on a little bit. We're going to talk about what makes the festival special. I think it's something that makes this show special. I think we share a common idea of bringing us all together, across all genres, and trying to reach out to audience members that would otherwise not be there. So, for example, somebody might be there to see the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, and then they might see this incredible kid. The guy's 21 years old, Jontavious Willis, play blues in a way that I've never seen it performed ever before. Chris Eldridge and Julian Large were there. Chris Eldridge from the Punch Brothers. It was really, really, really special. I even interviewed the first 22-year-old. That's right. What was her name? She was there. Sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful. Alberta Curry, who's a student of Sharon Isbin's, was there, and we put her on. We did it. We went for it. You know how I feel about 22-year-olds. But in this case, I did it. This is also produced, not the show, but the festival was also produced by David Spellman, who produces the New York Guitar Festival. They share a lot of the same guests and principals. So what an unbelievable experience. Just getting out there, I was jogged creatively by the fact that I wasn't home, that I was in a different environment. I was sort of dealing with some stuff at home, too. So to get out of New York, what a gift. Anyway, keeping it tight. You know, you also can go to audibletrial.com/insider. That's audibletrial.com/insider for a 30-day trial and a free download of your choice. Have celebrities or other people read books into your ears. That's audibletrial.com/insider. Don't go to audible.com. Don't go there. I don't even know what that website is. It's audibletrial.com/insider. Make sure you put that /insider down there so I can make my $20 a year. And as always, make sure that you go to savageclassical.com. That's SAVAGE, classical.com, where Richard Sage, who just signed up for another year of sponsorship. Thank you so much, Richard, for your support. He will hook you up with the guitar of your dreams. If you can't visit Bay Shore, New York on Long Island, summer's coming to an end, but it's still hot out there, so you can still go to the beach and check out, some of the most beautiful guitars in the world right up here on the Eastern Seaboard, savageclassical.com. He can send you a guitar to try out. And if you send it back in one piece and it's not all scratched up and you haven't eaten a bowl of Cheerios out of it, it should be okay. Send it back and you'll get your money back. That's Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com, the most important sponsor of the show. And of course, El Nora Guitar Festival and the University of Illinois are sponsoring the next several episodes. So thank you to them as well. Today we're going to talk to the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet. You know who they are. Right, we've got William, Scott, Jonathan, and Matthew. course known as Pilgrim Boys. You know, with names like that, it's no wonder they play music from all over the world because they're all from Burbank. But we're going to talk to Mike Ross now from the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. He's going to tell us a little more about the festival and what it shares in common with our show.
You know, people in the arts and other realms like to talk about excellence a lot, and I certainly value excellence of various sorts, but sometimes that can be kind of coded, or it can lead to a narrowing of perspective. And my preference is to think of instead of using excellence all the time, think about the notion of high value.
And, right.
So if you think about high value, you can. Yeah, sure, you want to talk about technical mastery of craft or whatever, but
right.
but there are other forms of value that can come into the equation. And you were referencing local and regional artists earlier, and I believe very strongly that there is a kind of value that artistry that is grounded year-round
in a geographical
right. location or locale, there's a value to that, to the people of that place, that is different than the value of an artist visiting from another place around the planet or across the country or whatever. So we try all year long at Krannert Center to make sure that we are lifting up and showcasing local artistry as well as this fabulous artistry that comes from all around the planet.
And that's exactly what you do. And the other thing is with local artistry, I think one of the reasons why local artists struggle and or regional artists struggles is because you and I both know how it feels to be nervous on stage and when you don't get to play enough, when you don't get heard enough, and you finally get that shot in front of the audience,
yeah.
what it feels like when you're just not used to being up there.
I tell you that.
So giving them the opportunity to be in, like the studio last night, I think you brought in one guy that was just a great guy. He was just he's a singer-songwriter. I forget, was it Matt?
Matt Stewart?
Yeah, just like a straight up. Just like a great guy, sitting there. Maybe he's in a cover band, stuff like that. But those guys, like giving him the opportunity to do that, to grow, so that he can maybe,
exactly
grow into something else.
Well, and I think that there are a lot of different ways to think about strategies for combining artists, local and non-local, in order to communicate some values or messages.
Right.
That you feel are especially important. And some of those are kind of like always important, always have been important. And some of them are in response to more recent developments in the world. And I certainly believe that with all the stuff that's going out there, all the troubling stuff that's going out there in the world and in our country, I believe people from the full spectrum of opinions about
right.
Politics and religion and
right.
lifestyle and everything else, we have to figure out ways for people to gather despite their differences of opinion
right.
to share something that might actually be meaningful and good and enriching.
And that's kind of what Illinois seems to stand for.
Well, thanks.
What I'm saying? Like, just Illinois is this place in the Midwest that doesn't... it doesn't always go one way or the other.
Yeah.
We are in the Midwest. We are not in Chicago.
Yeah.
I got a plane from here.
Yeah.
Chicago. So,
right.
so no, we're not
we're in the heartland.
We're in the heartland.
And,
you land in corn.
Really, the prairie, the heartland, and it's something. I grew up on the West Coast.
So bringing it here is really important, whereas in New York, you feel like you're preaching to the choir. It's almost like... Talking about politics in New York, it's a little tiresome. You're just like,
well,
I get it.
I know what you mean.
And you are in a college town here.
Yeah. Well, yes. There's a great, there's a fabulous public discourse of differences of opinion
mm-hmm.
around, certainly around politics. And it's something that I treasure. I relish the opportunity to help Kranich Center be a place. I refer to Kranich Center a lot as a blending of classroom, laboratory, and public square. And the public square part for me is deeply important because, yes, this is a temple for the arts, so to speak, but if we're not thinking about the arts, if we're not thinking about more than just the arts per se or for art's sake, I do believe that artists and their art have given us reason to gather for millennia as humans, right?
Right.
And I think that we cannot fail to recognize the potential of that capacity to actually help people. I believe that if people can coexist, and not just coexist for a moment, but share something of potentially great, deep personal value as well as that sort of shared value, I think that is a contribution to help get us somewhere beyond where we are as a nation and as a world right now.
Well, connecting academic approaches, academic music, academic study, like you said, research, development, with its immediate surrounding community is something that has been an us and them divider. And it's something that has been used, that I think has been, you know, politically co-opted as a tool to create anger and resentment.
More.
And so when we do things, what you're talking about is you're talking about reconciling that divide. And that's a very beautiful thing, Mike.
Well, I'm glad you think of it that way. I certainly recognize that it's a goal that is eminently unachievable in terms of completeness, but if we can just make a little bit of progress here and there along the way, I feel the work is still worth giving it all you got.
Yeah, man. Me too. And so, you know, this is this year, this is a festival that, you know, unfortunately I haven't been able to promote this festival because this was a last minute sort of thing bringing
That's
me out here, which
okay.
I'm super happy to be here. But this, not next year, but this is an every 2 year thing.
Yeah, this is a biennial affair. Yeah. And I believe strongly that because we pace it that way, it gives us the time to think about things that we might not otherwise be able to think of if you're under the gun. Because we're also programming an entire season. You know, I think of every season.
Right, you have something in February
as a big festival.
Right.
But it's for me. I like the biennial rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And I sure hope that you can be around next time.
I will. I will be around. And it's, yeah, I like the biennial because that does give you time to book acts and then also make decisions about where you're going to put them.
Yeah.
For example, like I understand that what's going on in the studio was not at all what was going on. That's where the merch was last time.
Right, and the museum type stuff.
And this time, it was, I was there the entire time. I was in the studio the whole time. I mean, I would go outside a little bit, but I really liked the cabaret sort of feel.
Yeah, the club style. In the studio theater. It's a for your listeners. Yeah. It's a black box theater.
Yeah.
It'll seat up to 200, depending upon
it almost
how you
looks,
configure it.
For New Yorkers, it looks a little bit like BB King's.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the kind of vibe that we shoot for in terms of setting it up.
It's also
a venue that we transform into a contemporary dance venue
or a strip club.
Or just
a strip club.
I hadn't thought of that. Hey, you know, you're thinking revenue streams that I haven't considered.
I'm serious here. we turn it into that. Just sort of spinning around. Yeah, get a disco ball going.
You got some good thinking going.
Mike, I'm telling you got to bring me on staff. I'm tired. New York's killing me. All right, well, thanks so much for joining me, man.
Thanks, Brett.
Absolutely. All right, so that was my time with Mike Ross from the Kranich Center. And now we're going to talk to some of my original guitar heroes, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet. I know that I've been a little, you know, irreverent about people in the past. I may be getting used to the idea of talking to people. You have to understand this is a defense mechanism because I am talking to people that I have an immense amount of respect for. All the joking aside, here comes four of the best guitarists in the world. Hang out with each other all the time.
I would say Scott and I live pretty close. We're both... we both kind of have some similar interests, so we get together every now and then. But Bill lives farther away, Matt lives farther away, and they both have family situations. Well, that sounds bad, actually.
Do you have a family situation?
No, they have families.
Wait,
yeah.
Do you have a?
I don't.
I don't either, man.
Yeah. Okay.
What do we do?
Wingman.
What do you want to do? Wingman. You want to do wingman? I don't know. I'm in something right now. I don't know what's going to happen with it.
It's honestly not looking that good. I'm familiar with that situation. Yeah.
Right. So maybe I'll move out to LA. We'll start like a bakery.
Yeah.
So right now we're at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts.
Right.
At the El Nora Guitar Festival, and you guys just got out of performing in the studio up there, Pachelbel's Canon, which is Mike Ross's, I understand, favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, Mike Ross, the organizer, and he really wanted us to play our, as John said, we played our encore as our first and last tune. but it was really fun. They had to an uninitiated audience, it kind of like lays it out. This is what LAGQ kind of
is about.
Can do. You know, right. We start out classical, and then we just sort of unabashedly cover all these different styles.
Mm-hmm. I'm usually pretty abashed myself.
Yeah, John's abashed. Yeah.
I couldn't be more abashed.
I didn't even know that was a word. I thought it just started with the negative.
It's one of those words, right?
That's like one of those words. You never hear the positive.
I'm gruntled.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's disgruntled.
I'm abashed. Yeah.
I am, I think I'm a lot like you. I think I have a lot of Bill in me.
You do?
I do. I think I'm very, I'm a head-on guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I stay up at night. Do you do that?
Yep. Yes.
Do you lose a lot of sleep over things?
Well, it depends. Yeah. I've been pretty chilled out lately.
I want to be like him. I want to be like, he seems like he's just
it's
a safari guy.
It's the golf. It's the golf that keeps him.
You do golf?
On the even.
I do golf.
On the yeah.
By him, I mean John Deere. John.
Yeah.
I can't believe this is what's so fun is I've known you guys since I was a wee little boy.
Virtually.
And now I'm talking. Now my job is to talk to you. Like I don't care about that. Like this isn't like I'm not starstruck, but I am. I hope you guys know I am in fact very starstruck every time he calls me and says, "Hey, can we talk?" And we're putting on a new. I'm just like, oh my god.
Oh, stop.
You're showing.
No, I swear to God.
I'm not just all kissing the guitar quartets.
No, I don't. There are no good guitar quartets.
I do.
There are. I thought you guys knocked them all out.
Oh.
I thought you guys basically absorbed all of them. Paid them to not be a quartet and became a monopoly. Is that the way it works?
Can we do that?
You totally can.
No, actually.
Wow.
I mean,
I'm going to start a quartet, and then I'll be like, guys, all I need is like $300 to walk away from this.
I mean, in all seriousness, which is definitely not going to happen during this interview.
I'm sorry. It is.
You know, one of the things I guess we can be sort of proud of is, you know, we've been together for 37 years, and there you could count on one hand the number of guitar quartets back then. And now everywhere we travel, there's professional groups, and then tons of student groups, and it's really great to see
you guys.
You know, us and other great ensembles like the Assad Brothers and
definitely.
But in terms of guitar quartet, you know. I think we had a little bit to do with it, so it's...
But I am saying what I'm saying. I'm saying that was... I had the same experience with Sergio when I met him. It was just like, it's pretty, pretty cool. Anyway, aside from that...
We had dinner at Sergio's house last night.
Whatever, dude.
Yeah, name drop.
All you guys together deciding the fate of the world.
I know.
It's all decided, by the way.
It's all there.
Yeah.
It's like an Ayn Rand novel.
There you go.
Insert pun here.
I'm
the fountainhead. I don't know.
I'm just shrugging about it.
Yeah, you know what I know you can do, and I heard you do it on Scott Wolf's program. Is you do impressions?
Yes.
And I'm
not going to do it now.
You don't have
to
do it now.
Special.
Yeah.
What if I give
sidebar.
You $5? What?
That'll be a whole sidebar.
Okay, yeah. We'll do that the next time we need to talk about something. Let's go over to Matt. Matt, we're just going to skip Scott completely. Scott, give him the microphone. No, I'm just joking. Scott, give him the microphone. But so as far, let's hear your story. You're the new guy still.
The new guy, only 11 years.
Right? Only 11 years, right?
Right.
But it's been a while. And did you? Your story is that you study with?
Yeah, I studied with Bill
uh-huh.
and Jim Smith at USC,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I. Scott was actually just leaving, just finishing his studies when I arrived. So. Mm-hmm. Way back. And, so long story short, I got a couple degrees at USC and went out into the world and gigged and did all sorts of things. And I had had some, I had quite a bit of jazz and bluegrass and various things in my background. So when I left school, even though I had studied classical really in a focused way, I kind of missed the creativity of improvisation and writing and things like that. So I went whole hog into jazz for a while. And
really?
Yeah. And so anyway, I was kind of doing both and gigging and doing, you know, the occasional like serious concerts, and sure. I was doing everything. But when Andy York decided it was time to pursue his solo career,
his
little
dancing
more.
Career.
Yeah, yeah. And these guys were looking for people to audition. They called me up because we'd kept in touch, and they knew that I did things besides classical. So anyway, that's the short story.
Yes, yeah, so the composition element. I mean, you also compose. You guys are, I mean, you guys are doing it. You guys are really...
I have done it. You know, actually, the composition hasn't happened for me in a while. I'm waiting for the muse to strike again.
That's not a bad idea.
You know, but a lot of arrangements. Definitely a lot of arrangements.
You did the jazz. How was that? How did you feel doing that? Did you feel like there was a venue for that anymore
this
country?
At that point,
not just like a small $30 a night gig?
Well, yeah, it's always been a small $30 a night gig. But and especially at that point, there still was, I mean, this was the mid to late 90s.
Oh, yeah, you know, there was a different attitude about it back then.
It was quite a while now. And, you know, the scene was a little bit more vibrant. I mean, I was gigging like two or three like jazz club gigs a week, you know, in Southern Central California. You can't really do that as much now.
No, it's a whole different scene.
And actually, it's probably dropping to like $25
a night. Literally, no, it's really, it's actually even jam bands and stuff like that. I've been talking with a lot of the publicists because I'm kind of part of a press corps, really. So I've been talking to them about the state of things, and this festival is doing very well, but this festival is kind of, it does embrace that element of what I think was going on in the late 90s a lot, which was John McLaughlin being there, David Grisman, all of them starting a festival in the woods, and maybe Jerry Garcia would play it, and then you guys would come in, or something like that. There was like that kind of thing happening, and now there's a much more indie rock.
Right.
I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Mac DeMarco or any of those people, but there's like a whole, there's a different thing going on.
Well, instrumental music in general has become a little less popular, a little less mainstream, and it's hard on artists. But I'm actually really impressed with this festival.
They're really pushing that.
Well, it's cross genre, but there's a lot of attendees. I mean,
there's so many.
It's pretty healthy. Yeah.
It's really big for something that's not. Yeah. It's been 7 years old, I guess they're saying, but I think it's. I don't know when. I still have to talk to David and see when he got involved with it. So that was a thing, and then you came back to it. You came back to the classical guitar because these guys are a vehicle too.
Well, I never really left it totally. My focus had changed for a while, but yeah, then I started doing it more, and then I did a brief stint in the Faya Trio, and that pulled me back even more. And you know, that's a group, you know, where everybody was interested in classical and jazz, so it kind of pulled me back into classical a little more strongly. So. You know, the timing was just really good. When these guys thought of auditioning me, I was doing both, and you know, I've always loved both. So it just kind of worked out.
That's
well
good
for me.
That's you know? Good. But the jazz, you had I imagine some amount of success. I mean, you were
I mean it was mostly kind of, you know, local to California,
yeah, local,
kind of
yeah, regional, yeah,
regional, but I was serious about it, and you know, it was really more about. You know, kind of realizing something that was really important to me. I just wanted to be a really good improviser. I wanted to write. You know, to me, it's all one thing. You know, art music is one thing, and I just really, that was an itch I needed to scratch, you know, and get into it a little deeper. So
being creative is something that, you know, I think going out and doing that is really important. Allowing for the improvisational aspects, Scott, how do you handle... I mean, I don't know exactly, but I do see you guys play a lot on stage. Are you improvising as much? Are you improvising a lot, Matt?
There are a few places in the program where I do improvise.
We'll pick them up in post.
But usually, beyond that, not a lot.
But as far as, I mean, Scott, do you do a lot of the improvising? Or I mean, 'cause
no,
you come from a straight-up competition... You know,
pretty much straight up classical background.
Yeah.
I don't really improvise. I mean, I can do a little improvisation, but not jazz at all. I can do a little improvisation, like I can.
Yeah.
I can be melismatic.
Yeah.
In
like jam bands. We're all jam bandy. We're all from that era.
I can totally be. I can deliver a melisma like nobody. in your name a Renaissance piece, I'll melisma. And a flamenco I played a lot, so I can kind of groove a little bit in that.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
But jazz, no. When I was a kid, I had a jazz guitarist as a teacher, Joe Fava, in Detroit.
Yeah.
And he was very well. He produced any jazz musician in that area right now. He had something to do with Joe Fava. And he was always trying to get me to do my, you know, my scales and triads and fourths and fifths and octaves and all that. And I did it, but I was really I just wanted to know, how do I play fast and loud?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Triads and a scale triad, you know. Hey.
Right. Oh, somebody else already did this, right?
Can I play fast and loud? Then I'll do it. And the poor guy, too. I just loved him. And he had I was the youngest student he ever accepted. Yeah. And he had an ulcer. And every lesson, I would just, the first thing I'd play something, he'd go, it's too fast, man. He would say words like man and dig. You know, well, he was old school.
That's cool.
By the end of the lesson, man, his hand was in his shirt, rubbing his ulcer. And I just made him sick.
He would say, too fast.
And too fast, man.
Calm down, Daddy.
Too fast, and head in hands, you know.
I think that language is definitely something that is timeless at this point. I'm always into that. Daddy, slow down, man. Dig it.
Dig it. Love, dig it.
All that beatnik stuff.
Daddy-o.
Speaking of the beatnik.
Yeah.
I feel like it. I mean,
you talking to me?
I'm talking to you. I love it. So tell me about, where do you come from, Mr. Dearman?
Yeah. I was born a poor black child, as Steve Martin said. But did you see that? The jerk?
The jerk. Of course I see this.
Sure.
I can't remember all of it, but I love it very much.
No. I come from, I guess you could say I come from kind of steel string, finger style stuff.
Did you see the thing upstairs?
I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen a lot of that stuff in my life, and up close and from a distance and all that. I mean, in other words, being kind of involved in that mm-hmm. world a little bit, and then now mostly just enjoying it. But yeah, I kind of, just a very short version, I kind of went through the thing of like, oh, buy young Johnny a guitar and then take him to guitar lessons, and it was like utter fail on guitar lessons. Like, I was on page 6 of the Alfred Guitar Method for like 3 months, and then...
So you are really, you're straight up from like the acoustic guitar method book.
And then when after I got like fired from guitar lessons, a couple years later, I kind of just started, I picked up a Peter, Paul, and Mary book and learned about tablature, and then I got into slowing stuff down on records.
Yeah.
And then I just learned everything by Chet Atkins, basically.
Is that where I forget where you said you were from. Where are you from?
That was in Minneapolis originally, and then I moved to the West Coast when I was
But you had like
9.
A country family or something?
No, but I sort of did later. No, not at all. My dad was a pharmacist. There was no... Well, you may be thinking Matt's mom was in the Nashville scene. She was on Hee Haw and all that.
Oh, is that right?
Fiddle player.
Was a fiddle player on Hee Haw?
Yep.
Do you know Mike Schneider, the banjo player who's at the Grand Ole Opry now?
You know, I know that name, but I'm not.
Guy's
super
the funniest guy of all time.
Really?
I was at the Grand Ole Opry last week, 2 weeks ago. My friend Eamon, my college roommate, is the lead fiddle player there. And Mike Schneider just talks like this. And he's sitting there and he goes, and Eamon's English. And he goes, you all should listen to Eamon. The English language started with Eamon, and it ended with me. And he was on Hee Haw, too. He was the banjo player on Hee Haw.
Really?
Your mom and him probably played together.
Probably, yeah. She was in Buck Owens' band.
Yeah.
And, she popped out of the haystack a few times.
No, I didn't come from a musical family, but my dad, for some reason, my dad really liked guitar stuff. So he had like records by, he had a lot of Chet Atkins. He had a guy named Bola Sette. Has anybody heard of Bola?
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was in Bola Sette.
Yeah.
We had Charlie Bird, and so Lorenzo Almeida. But I really got hooked on Chet, so I learned stuff off records. Then it was like, then I got into Leo Kottke and John Fahey and Peter Lang and all those guys. And and then basically I ran into a guy who was studying with the Romeros. This is when I got out of high school, and I was gigging and teaching. And I ran into a guy who studied with Celine Romero, and I walked into a music shop where I had just started working as a fingerstyle teacher. And I met this guy for the first time, and he was playing something that was extremely beautiful, and I just really stopped, almost literally stopped in my tracks and listened to him, and I said, that was amazing. Where'd you learn that? And he said, I studied with one of the Romero brothers, and I knew who they were, but, you know, so he took me over there, like, to the next week or something, and I played for Celine, and I played Chet Atkins' version of Yellowbird, and I played a version of, I played one of the Laro waltzes that I learned off a Chris Parkening record, because I learned everything off records. And then I started studying with Celine, and then Pepe, and then USC, and then these guys.
You started studying with them, too?
No, right? Well, you could say, in a sense, no, I mean, we went to school together. No.
Didn't you study with Bill?
No.
Scott? No.
No.
You guys were at the same time.
Pretty much. Bill and I were almost exactly the same time. Scott was just a couple years behind.
I feel like I'm being...
But we're all different ages. So because I kind of messed around for a couple of years after high school. And
what do you mean messed around with him?
You know, I was gigging and teaching, right. And I had no intention of going to school. Like, if it wasn't for, like, what happened with the Romeros and with these guys, I would be playing at a bar in Escondido, California right now. Like, literally right now.
Escondido's where you...
That's kind of where my stamping grounds, yeah. But you said something about a bluegrass family, because the shop I was teaching in was like a heavy bluegrass scene. Everybody's like playing banjos and stuff. And that's when I walked in this one day, and this guy's playing classical guitar, and I thought, that sounds interesting. And then when I met the Romeros, I thought, okay, this is what I need to do, because these people, this is a real opportunity. You just recognize like this awesomeness about them and the competence, right? And the star power and all that. And I had every kind of instrument, and I just sold them all, and I bought a Contreras, and a couple years later I met Bill, and then off we went.
Yeah, it really bites you, doesn't it? The classical guitar. I think everybody, I mean, you know, like you're saying, you were studying with Joe Favo in Detroit, and that's a situation where, you know, you... You ended up starting out. I mean, he was not a classical guy, right?
He played classical and taught classical. He was one of
But once you hear them do that, you're just like, as a guitarist, you're like, and then you don't realize it, but then you're doing it for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it gets, I feel like, a little limiting, you know, in that way.
But the thing about all of us is that we all got bitten by the classical guitar bug.
Yeah.
And, you know, went full into it, but our interest and love for other styles is really kind of what's defined us in a way.
You guys, especially.
Yeah, because, mm-hmm. you know, having done, you know, all these different non-classical things, but with a classical aesthetic, I guess.
Well, that's why we're going up to see Chris and Julian, like, pretty soon. You know? It's so important. Yeah.
Well, and I guess, you know, to weave in that, like, maybe the ultimate, you know, realization of that is, you know, doing this piece by Pat Metheny, you know, which is... You know, like one of our absolute heroes, and we're still pinching ourselves that he even knows who we are.
Yeah,
you know, but
a little less is writing a piece for you guys.
Yeah, and you know,
well, it wasn't just the piece, but the commitment, like all the hours of rehearsal that he spent with us.
Yeah.
all the time on the phone and on email,
and also to write not just a little piece, you know, but a 6-movement, 25-minute. Symphonic scaled, you know, epic work, you know, that he really poured his soul into, and then you know was very committed to the project, and it kind of, you know, forced us to like say how can we do this thing justice, you know, like what, you know, and how can we try to sound like Pat when we need to sound like Pat, you know,
and
it's a big challenge, but really rewarding.
Was it a big challenge? Was it idiomatically written?
It was.
And I don't think he'd be mad.
Yeah.
You know, if you guys told.
Well, I mean, he's a guitarist, obviously, so he has, you know, he knows particularly how the left hand works. The only thing that was. Everything was idiomatic, but some things were not easy for us to do. Let's put it that way. So especially rhythmic, super rhythmic stuff that had a lot of strumming in it, because as you probably know, maybe with some of your experience in guitar, like exactly the touch you have when you're doing like long extensive strumming sections, you got to have a certain kind of. First of all, you got to figure out, is it, you know, is it down up down, is it down, you know, up down 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 down,
right,
up up up,
right, right.
And so we got into long, long discussions about that with him testing out everything, because he wasn't even sure himself. So he would like sit down and go, well, actually, that doesn't work. Like what he wrote, it's like, that doesn't really work, does it? And we finally figure it out. But then getting like stresses and ghosting notes and like all that, that was hard to do. So, but other than that, it was mostly idiomatic. He often wrote some like densely chordal, like dense chordal sections that we kind of thought, you know, it's really hard. Like, you have to do a really hard kind of chord melody thing that's like, well, everybody else is playing that same chord, so why don't we just thin out the person who's playing the melody, like, thin out his chords a bit. So some of it was non-idiomatic in that way, like maybe a little too hard to play.
Right.
Even though, I don't know if that's because on the thicker neck it was hard, and I think for him, sometimes he said, well, that's not that hard to play, is it?
Well, he would do which the, is he would do the thumb wraparound thing, which, of course, as you know, is illegal in classical guitar.
It's illegal. We've decided on
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
So we told him, actually, it's really hard to do on a classical neck because it's thicker, you know. And
yeah.
And he asked us, actually, do you guys do that? And because he was planning, in fact, he sent us a little zip drive of him demoing some how to strum.
Yeah.
And some of the chords had been sort of thumb over fingered, so he could get that extra note where we couldn't.
Yeah, in a situation like that, it's like you also, you know, in the interest of hand health, you don't want to be constant. In my experience, I don't think you want to be constantly challenged by foreign technique.
Right.
I think that's something that we're starting, at least I feel like I'm starting to understand, is that the constant introduction in guitar of foreign technique, as opposed to the more standardized way that they're playing pianos and violins, is starting to affect us physically in ways we might not be able to comprehend. So I'm not always the biggest fan of like, well, you know, the composer did this or something like that I don't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, well, Pat Metheny wants you to do something.
Well,
you
I would,
do it.
But he was really, really open. Like,
yeah,
like,
he seems like he's
And you know, he was sort of saying, you know, this is a learning experience for me too. I mean, one of the things he said right off the bat was, you know, it was very unusual for him to have to notate everything that he wanted everyone to do. He said, usually, you know, I write these tunes and I have my harmonic structure. I know exactly, you know what the rhythm is. I know exactly how to do it. But I just write a chart and everybody fills in all the little details. And he said, here I need to really score it, like really be specific. And he took a kind of serious view of it. Like he mentioned a couple times that he saw this score as like this testament of his, that you know, he said, you know, 60 years from now, none of us are going to be around, and I want this score to realize my vision, you know, my you know, so
he wants it documented. He wants it down. He wants something down.
Yeah, and so he was really interested in us, you know, helping to, you know, to codify things, and he was flexible with it.
It's really brave when somebody that age does something like that. That's a real brave and a very rare thing when someone is constantly building like that. But a guy like that, you know, you figure that he's been doing that.
Yeah, and I think
he's never stopping.
Also, this piece, you know, the title is "Road to the Sun," and you know, I think he saw it as kind of, you know, like this somewhat poetic version of like a life journey, you know, a quest for something. I don't want to get too high-handed. He doesn't like to assign specific meaning to any music, but I think he was trying to express, you know, this this large-scale movement with so many different moods involved, like a kind of statement of truth, in a sense, of this statement, and then groove stuff and aleatoric scratching sounds and all kinds of really interesting textures, but you know, trying to express this, you know, kind of deeply held feeling.
It came through.
I think so.
You guys premiered it in New York, I think, last year, right?
Actually, we premiered it in Denver. And then we played it 3 weekends in a row, and the third one was at the 92nd Street Y.
Right, and I couldn't go because I was teaching in a middle school, and I quit.
You'll get to
Pat Metheny writes another.
You'll hear it tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be here tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So now I get to hear it. Actually, what am I talking about? I don't have to go to middle school tomorrow. You know why? Because I quit.
No, and you're on
Saturday.
Detention.
What?
You're on detention.
No, I wasn't fired. I'm fine. But it's as far as that was it, I mean, it was really embarrassing because you were like, do you want to come? And I was like, at the gym. And I'm like, I don't want to go anywhere, Bill. I just want to go home and cry. But it's... But I definitely, yeah, I missed out on that. As far as the John, did you ever leave the quartet at one point? Is that right? Is that okay to say?
I think that's like a Paul, like a rumor thing, like a Paul thing with the Beatles, yeah. Right? Yeah. I didn't die. I didn't leave.
John is the walrus.
Yeah, I'm John is the walrus. No. No, but, you know, I mean, Bill and Scott, I think it's because Bill and Scott
John
are...
John is the walrus.
Yeah. I think it's because Bill and Scott are such, like, high-profile people, and I'm like the guy in the background.
How do you feel about that? But I mean, is it somewhat? I mean, are you more chill?
I didn't mean to have an awkward silence. It's just Scott put his hand on my shoulder so people couldn't see that.
We'll
no,
all do that.
I mean, what do I say about that? It doesn't mean anything. It's like I'm lucky to play in this group. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And as far as like what you're doing when you're not with the quartet. What's going on?
I didn't really go into solo guitar playing for like a combination of reasons.
Yeah,
some of it had to do with some physical challenges.
Okay,
and like the amount of time I could log on the guitar, like
right.
in a day or a sustained period. There were some challenges there for me.
Yeah, I hear that.
And
yeah.
Then at a certain point, it became like, well, I mean, this may sound a little bit weird to say, but I kind of felt like, you know. I don't know if I'm good enough to do that. I mean, I know that there's always like, well, everybody has something to say, and if you've got a certain threshold of technical ability, you should be able to get up on stage and do your thing and say your piece. But I never really felt compelled to do that. I didn't.
I think it's the compulsion.
Yeah, and yeah. I have an outlet. Yeah, right.
Right.
So there wasn't a compulsion for me, but and as far as an outlet to. To contribute in some way artistically in the world or the community or whatever, I had that opportunity already. So, so maybe I don't know. Maybe I should have done it, but I didn't. And
no, and I don't completely. Think it has anything to do with it's. I was really brokenhearted when I was in a group with somebody, and they left. They just didn't want to perform, but they were an outstanding guitarist.
Yeah,
better guitarist than me. And I was, well, you know, whatever, there's lots of those. But the point is that outstanding guitarist. And I went to my teacher, Fred Hand,
yeah. Mm.
at the time, and I said, like, I don't know what to do. I don't know where, I don't feel like I have a career. You know, I was 20.
Yeah.
I don't have a career anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he's like, look, you know, you can't be mad at him. He's like, just because you're a good guitarist doesn't mean you want to perform all the time.
Absolutely.
You know? Whereas I'm a song and dance man. I'm like, just right. give me a stage and give me a mic.
Yeah, right.
And the guitar? Okay, I'll do that.
Right.
You know?
I never had that.
You never
compulsion.
Had the song. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That I've got to perform. I've got to show my stuff all the time. There's other things I'm interested in. So.
Yeah. No. I'm like I'm bothering a girlfriend or I'm bothering somebody on the phone. I'm trying to make, a person laugh or I'm just like I'm a mess that way. So, but to expect my buddy to be that way. And I'm like, you need to talk more. We should have more fun. Let's go tour more. Let's, all that stuff. It really, it's everybody has their own temperament when it comes to that.
It's nice that he had the, I guess, the
balls.
Yeah, right. Or
really to walk away.
The confidence, yeah.
Yeah.
The confidence to say, you know what?
I don't want
to
do this, yeah. He's like, I'd rather play and whatever, figure this whole life out.
Yeah.
Really cool. But what really strikes me is a lot of duos come in here, and they seem to be very similar in their temperament and in their approach. There's not a lot in common between the two of you, Bill and Scott.
We're all four.
You
very
are
different,
four very different, different players,
and different, totally different
personalities,
worldview.
Right.
Yeah, but we all share this love you know, for what we
for
do.
For Donald Trump, we all share.
Absolutely. You said the T word, didn't you? No. He whose name shall not be mentioned. No. No. But, you know, one could, you know.
I'm sorry, Scott. We can edit it out.
No, I know. What, you know, but you could say that, you know, it's the individual personalities
right.
that are part of the thing that makes the quartet work. Because, you know, when you have four guys all playing the same exact instrument, if we all played the same exact way and we all, you know, looked the same way and bowed exactly the same, it would just become...
That would be very boring.
It would be very boring, yes.
Do you remember when people used to wear the same suits?
Oh, God. Oh,
I used to do that.
We tried that.
I think, did you guys do that? All black or all gray?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't work for the Beatles.
I remember Brazil Guitar Quartet did it. We all did it. We all had the same suits. And unbelievable. What were we thinking? That wasn't that. That's 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What's the matter with us?
Yeah.
Well, you
know, go ahead.
But,
you know, there is a kind of...
Well, there is a deep down, there is a connection that... There's kind of our adult selves that we are now, and then there's the genesis of the quartet coming from USC and the Romeros and all the shared experiences we had back in the early late 70s with Bill and I and early 80s. And so there's that, even though 30, 40 years down the line we've kind of gone in our separate ways, but we have that, what's the word I'm looking for? It's just this kind of
California.
The shared experience yeah. of, I think really it goes to Pepe and the whole Romero vibe there, the Spanish music, even though we don't really focus on that. But I guess it's just Pepe. Well, Pepe's a unique individual.
Well, and it's also, you know, like I think our greatest achievement is the fact that we've been together for 37 years. Like, we've kept it
all
together.
All you have to do is stay together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
And be good.
Well, and be good, you know. I mean, if we weren't good after 37 years, there'd really be a problem.
Right.
You know, but in a way, what it means is that even though we're really different, we're extremely different personality types, we have to figure out ways to work together as a team, and we have to figure out ways to compromise when we disagree and to somehow come... You know,
well, hopefully, be able to capitalize on our differences. You know, not from such a negative thing of like avoiding conflict or whatever, but like how do we make best use of everybody's ideas, everybody's strengths,
right?
Not just guitar playing, but like their musical strengths or their musical predilections. Yeah.
Well, and it's very important not to wife swap either.
I know
you don't want to do that.
Do you know actually? You know, I was talking to Mike Ross about this. There is a string quartet, the Quartetto Italiano, that had four guys and a woman.
Well, three guys
there. Three guys and a woman. I'm sorry. And
oh my God.
And she was married to each of the members at one time or another.
Can you
imagine?
Was that difficult?
Have we Wikipedia?
That is so.
Could be urban legend, but that's what we heard.
Yeah. And that is the Los Angeles guitar.
Yeah.
The reason we're ending this a little early, and we've already got 33, I think, very good productive minutes. I think we did a good job.
That's what we're about, production.
Keep telling yourself that, man.
But it's 5:43, and I feel like if I can get you upstairs at 5:45, like we want to, you guys,
we'll do it.
You'll love me forever.
Well, can I interject like the totally glib thing about since we're talking about our interpersonal dynamic?
Yeah, and please, if you want to finish, we can do it.
I've always felt like, you know,
I can go on for longer if you want.
Well, no,
I'd love to.
I just want to say I really do feel like Scott, John, and I are in like brothers. I mean, we've known each other for like, you know, way more than half of our lives.
And Matt's
well,
okay,
no. And we kind of have this dynamic. I kind of think, you know, within a family, you know, you bicker, you disagree, but you have each other's back,
right.
You know, ultimately.
Yeah.
And there's all this emotional baggage from something that happened, you know, when you were 3 years old or something,
right.
but you have each other's back, and it's kind of like I'm sort of the overbearing older brother in a way, you know, the controlling guy, and John's the archetypal kind of, you know, rebel, recalcitrant, you know, devil's advocate, and Scott is just like the super brilliant one who just kind of is maybe in a fog sometimes, you know, and then super happy and then you could say, well,
basically,
what about Bill, Matt?
Scott's more like, you know, you guys go ahead and argue. I mean, I'll be over here when you're ready to play.
But, do not leave.
But then I think that Matt, to be honest, is it, because he's relatively new and he's a little younger. He's like our nephew, who just is like, just I love you guys, and I'll do anything for you guys. And he's always been.
Matt's
the referee. Matt is the referee.
But Matt has always been, ever since he's been in the group, just, you know, you could just, he doesn't take it for granted like we do. He really loves it, and he's brought this great new energy to the group.
100%. And you can see you're reflected in him. I remember that new, like, your behavior, you're like, you notice it more.
Yeah.
I bet. When you have a new person in the room. So. Whereas to the old people, you're just like, kind of like, how you doing? I'm fine. But like a new person comes in, how are you doing? You okay?
Yeah.
That's like, true. you know, completely, what a healthy thing to do.
Yeah.
Basically, all of our friends should be replaced.
Yes. We'll start with you.
Please stop. I'm just getting started. Okay. I wouldn't be anywhere without Bill, who was the first celebrity guest on the show.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. And you took a chance.
I did.
You drove out.
I did.
And we got along.
We did.
Scott came on shortly thereafter. Now I got Matt, and I would love to talk to you guys. If you're ever in New York and you just want to sit and talk.
Yeah, let's get a coffee.
Please, come over. Let's do it. Guys, we're going to see Julian and Chris upstairs.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It's some of the best stuff. I would say there's a guy named Jontavious Willis, an 18-year-old blues kid. Best in show. One of the best things I've ever seen in my life.
Oh my God.
When's
just
that? When
a blues
that?
Guy, just completely free and funny and moving. I don't even know if it's. We might have missed it, but he's unbelievable.
Hmm.
Watch out for this kid. Anyway,
cool.
And of course, the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, the greatest guitar quartet in human history, the greatest guitar quartet possible. Write it down. Good luck and good night.
This is a piece by Louis Milan off the album New Renaissance by the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, released, I believe, last year, 2 years ago. And I remember me and Bill talking about it when it came out. Anyway, next time I'm going to have Makana, also from the El Nora Guitar Festival at the University of Illinois Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Makana is a Hawaiian guitarist, and you know, we talk about Hawaii. See you next time.